Hi and welcome to the Biographics Podcast. I am your host, Simon Whistler, and in today's episode, we've got another one we've taken from our YouTube channel. If there are any sort of weird abnormalities, because this is the taking of a video from YouTube and the rebroadcasting of the audio in a podcast form, if there's anything weird and funky, that's probably just because it was intended for a video audience first, but hopefully you will enjoy it all the same. Let's roll into today's episode. Everyone and their dog knows about Russian scientist Ivan Pavlov and, well, his dog and how he trained it to drool on command at the sound of a bell. His discovery of conditioned reflexes won him a Nobel Prize in Physiology. It's pretty straightforward, right? Well, no, actually. Much of what we know about Pavlov's experiment has been misrepresented and mistranslated. So, well, join me in today's biographics to learn the truth behind Ivan Pavlov's research and his fascinating life. And just a word of warning before we get started, if you happen to watch these videos with your canine friends, this is one where you might want to cover their eyes. Ivan Petrovich Pavlov was born in Ryazan in the Russian Empire, about 200 miles from Moscow, on September 26, 1849. Ivan's father, Petr, was a local Orthodox parish priest, a well-liked and respected figure who supplemented the family's income by growing his own vegetables and brewing his own vodka-based fruity liqueur. Ivan was a frail and sickly child, one you might immediately assign to the role of bookworm, except that he had absolutely no power of concentration. He hated reading and had a pretty volatile temper. In fact, he avoided homework as often as he could, preferring to help Petr in tending to his plot of land. At the age of 8, Ivan suffered a bad fall, plunging from a tall fence onto a stone slab. As he struggled to recover from his injuries, his godfather, also a priest, stepped in. For some reason, he believed that what the boy needed was not a proper trauma assessment or a doctor, but rather discipline, discipline, and more discipline. So he took Ivan to his monastery, where the boy, for several months, lived like a monk. The therapy did produce some results. Bored out of his mind, Ivan started doing something he had never considered: reading. With little other recourse, the young boy learned to enjoy it, devouring the monastery's library. When he returned home, his personality had changed. He was calmer, more focused, and had a great desire to learn. Petr reignited his hopes of sending Ivan to seminary to become a new addition to the Pavlov family's roster of clergymen. The other pivotal moment in young Ivan's life was when his uncle, also a priest, also named Ivan, moved in with a family. If Petr wanted to provide his son with two strong role models, it'd done a pretty rubbish job, as Uncle Ivan was a terrible priest. Shortly after he was assigned to his most recent church, local parishioners had started reporting ghastly sightings of a white-robed figure stalking the graveyard. Bodies were dug out from their tombs and simply disappeared. The church bells had the habit of going off at the most ungodly hours of the night. Of course, it was all thanks to Uncle Ivan, who enjoyed playing a prank or two while drunk like a baboon at a bachelor party. When the parishioners found out, they cornered Uncle Ivan, thrashed him like a snare drum at a napalm death recording session, and kicked him out of the village. Uncle Ivan's only choice was to move in with his brother Petr, where he apparently sobered up and developed a strong bond with little Ivan. The boy loved the elder Ivan, from whom he heard stories about his other uncle, also a priest, also named Ivan, because why choose new names when you can confuse amateur historians instead? Okay, so about Uncle Ivan, the second one. Was he a good priest? Well, not really. His favorite pastime was a sort of brawling much in fashion during those days. Basically, the men of one street or an entire village would fuel up on enough vodka to floor a company of Varangians, then challenge a rival team of equally intoxicated sluggers. Think of it as a Russian Donnybrook. Now, I don't know about you, but from my experience, this is not typical behavior of priests. Anyhow, Uncle Ivan II once took his brawl too far, and he died as a result of his injuries. I'm not sure if such role models would encourage young minds to take up priesthood, but these experiences surely taught a vital lesson to the young Ivan: the importance of moderation and the avoidance of all excesses in life. With a strong moral compass installed by the tales of his elder Ivans, Pavlov was finally sent to study at seminary. His experience at the religious school started promisingly, but soon Ivan was distracted by the irresistible allure of a demanding mistress: science. During the early 1860s, Russian society had initiated a period of economic, social, and cultural reforms promoted by Tsar Alexander II, who ascended to the throne in 1855. Most notable was the abolition of serfdom, which totally revolutionized the Russian economy. Another key element of these reforms was the promotion of science to foster modernization of the state. As a result, local public libraries were stocked with scientific works by both Russian and foreign authors that were previously unavailable. Ryazan's public library was flooded by Ivan and his friends, who had formed a discussion circle to review and analyze modern scientific discussions. Works like Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species or the journals by radical scientist Dmitry Psarev. One book would be particularly relevant in Ivan's future career, Reflexes of the Brain by Ivan Sechenov. In this book, the author argued that all human behaviors and thoughts could be explained as a result of machine-like reflexes and reactions. Young Ivan's thirst for knowledge was so avid that he would not allow any obstacle to come in his way. If the seminary demanded that he studied all day, he would read at night or very early in the morning. When access to the library became so crowded that fistfights exploded regularly, he convinced a librarian to keep a window always open at the back so that he could climb into a reading room undisturbed and get on with his extracurricular activities. In 1869, Ivan could no longer continue his ruse of progressing his religious and scientific studies along parallel tracks. He had to let go of something, and that something was religion. He quit the ceremony and enrolled at the University of St. Petersburg to study chemistry and physiology, the branch of biology that deals with the normal functions of living organisms and their parts. Peter Pavlov was not pleased with this decision, but Ivan put his foot down. He would stand by his rational choices, regardless if these would sour his personal relationships. In a later letter to his future wife, Ivan compared himself to one of the brothers Karamazov from the novel by Fyodor Dostoevsky. One of the brothers, also named Ivan, was a rationalist and an extreme skeptic, condemned to social isolation for his nihilism. By 1875, Ivan had earned a degree and doctorate from the Imperial Medical Academy and continued his studies under renowned physiologists Rudolf Heidenhain and Karl Ludwig. At the same time, he had enrolled at the Academy of Medical Surgery, where in 1879 he attained his third degree and was awarded a gold medal for academic results. Ivan's studies were crowned by his doctor's thesis, published in 1883. Its title was The Centrifugal Nerves of the Heart. This sounds like a bad Bonnie Tyler outtake, but was actually a pioneering work in which he laid down the basic principles of the trophic function of the nervous system. In other words, the role of the nervous system in nutrition. In the meantime, Ivan had married a teacher called Serafima Karchayevskaya, also known as Sarah, in 1881. Their first years together, though, were not happy. Initially, the couple lived in almost complete poverty while Ivan was still perfecting his studies. They had to frequently crash at friends' houses or rent bug-infested attics. Tragically, Sarah's first pregnancy ended in a miscarriage. According to the doctors at the time, this was caused by Sarah's constant attempts to keep up with Ivan, who was a very fast walker. Ivan and Sarah soon tried to have another child, and Vertik was born shortly afterwards. Unfortunately, the baby boy died suddenly while an infant. Despite their grief, the couple's life improved in the following years. In 1890, Ivan received a series of appointments which improved their financial situation. He was first invited to direct the Department of Physiology at the Institute of Experimental Medicine, a post that he would hold for the next 45 years. Then he was hired by the Military Medical Academy, first as a professor of pharmacology, then as a chair of physiology. All that hard work and study had eventually paid off. They were also blessed with four healthy children, Vladimir, Viktor, Vishlovod, and Vera. With his professional and personal life on track, Ivan Pavlov launched into the research that really mattered to him, the one on the physiology of digestion. This took place at the Institute of Experimental Medicine from 1891 to 1900 and would make him a household name. Okay, back to Ivan Pavlov and his experiments. First, let's cover his methodology. It may sound commonplace today that science should be grounded on data produced via experimentation, but when Pavlov emerged as a notable scientist, this wasn't necessarily a given when it came to physiology. Pavlov was the first physiologist in the Russian Empire to devote himself to repeated experimentation, applying a factory-like approach to his lab. Pavlov recognized that meaningful changes in the normal functions of a living organism could be assessed only over time. Pavlov's contemporaries would experiment on an animal, then discard it or even kill it once the experiment was done. Pavlov instead preferred to keep his animals alive, especially dogs, in order to document physiological changes over a longer time span. He referred to this method as chronic experiments. Okay, so this is the moment in the video today when you might want to cover your dog's ears or maybe send them to go play somewhere else. If Pavlov's lab was a factory, then the dogs were his machines. He performed surgical operations on every test subject, opening up a fistula along their digestive tracts. A fistula is an opening in a living organism which allows one to observe the inner workings of its organs. Pavlov needed these fistulas opened for two reasons. Number one, to observe the functioning of the dog's digestive functions, in particular the production of gastric juices, and two, to collect said secretions. So yes, Ivan Pavlov may not have systematically killed his lab animals, but their treatment wasn't exactly a walk in the park, which is, I suppose, what they were probably hoping for. It was a treatment that was painful at best and caused the death of the subjects at worst. Particularly in his early experiments, Pavlov was constantly stymied by the difficulty of keeping his subjects alive after operating on them. Even if one of his machines tragically died, Ivan was always ready to replace them. But what exactly did this factory, or lab, produce? Pavlov and his team cranked out scientific papers on the physiology of the digestive system, new research techniques, and an important byproduct, gastric juice. Liters of it. Ivan Pavlov was always strapped for research cash, and he had stumbled upon a lucrative side gig. Russian patients suffering from dyspepsia were ready to pay good money for canine gastric juice, considered an effective treatment at that time. Dyspepsia is more commonly referred to as indigestion, and includes symptoms such as bloating, discomfort, and nausea. So yes, if you're feeling nauseous and bloated, what better remedy could there be than gulping down a nice warm glass of thick, moist, pungent gastric juice freshly harvested from a fistulated, drooling dog. Yep. So yes, there was that. So moving very swiftly on, Pavlov had the perfect setup for his indigestion medicine factory. Five large dogs selected for their voracious appetites were harnessed on a long table. Each dog was subjected to an incision of the esophagus. This opened a fistula from which a tube led to the collection vessel. Each of these dogs faced a stand tilted to display a large bowl of minced meat just out of reach. This stimulated the production of saliva and gastric juices. By 1904, Pavlov's side gig was selling more than 3,000 bottles of gastric juice per year, raking in profits that would increase his lab's budget by 70%. Besides capitalizing on his own brand of furry tailorism, Pavlov began his research of what he called psychic secretions, which sounds like something Dr. Stenz or Dr. Spengler may want to analyze too. But in simple terms, psychic secretions were drool produced by anything other than direct exposure to food. And here is where we get to Pavlov's famous experiments. Just to clarify, it wasn't a single occurrence in which he rang a bell to get a dog to salivate, as sometimes thought by modern popular culture, but it was a chronic experiment in line with his scientific doctrine. This is how it worked. Pavlov's main research was meant to study the salivation of dogs in response to being fed. However, he soon noticed that dogs would begin salivating when they heard the footsteps of the assistant who would bring them their food. Pavlov's hypothesis was that any object or event which the dogs learned to associate with food would trigger the same response as food itself. He started from the idea that dogs or other complex organisms were hardwired to respond instinctively to certain stimuli. In other words, an unconditioned stimulus, for example, food, will elicit an unconditioned response, or salivation. Dogs will salivate in the presence of food. It's not a behavior that they need to learn. Unconditioned stimulus leads to unconditioned response. Pavlov then devised a series of experiments to validate his initial hypothesis. The first step was to introduce a neutral stimulus. This could be a metronome or an electronic buzzer, which in a mistranslated paper became the famous bell. The neutral stimulus did not elicit any response. Therefore, neutral stimulus leads to no conditioned response. Next, it was time to begin the conditioning procedure, that is, associating the neutral stimulus with the unconditioned stimulus. In this example, introducing a clicking metronome before the dog was served its chow. Finally, Pavlov played the metronome, but failed to produce the food. I'm sure the dogs were dead disappointed, but what mattered to the scientist was that the clicking itself did increase the drooling. So now a conditioned stimulus had elicited a conditioned response. This has also been described as conditional response in some translations of the original Russian articles. So, therefore, conditioned stimulus leads to conditioned response. Pavlov's experiments would become more sophisticated. For example, he tried playing around with specific metronome speeds, like serving food only when it clicked at 60 beats per minute. Over time, his dogs became so discriminating that they failed to salivate at any other setting. This led Pavlov to deduce that there were colliding forces of excitation and inhibition at play. At first, a stimulus may spread broadly across the cerebral cortex. The cortex is the area of the brain responsible for processing and interpreting input from various sources and maintaining cognitive function. In a second phase of selective reinforcement, the stimulus could be concentrated on one specific spot of the cortex. I should reinforce that Pavlov's interest was always grounded in physiology and in the understanding of the digestive system. However, his work did have a huge impact on the field of psychology. Pavlov's discoveries pushed behavioral psychologists into developing the concept of classical conditioning, also known as Pavlovian conditioning. This is a process of learning by association, which, according to behaviorists, can explain all aspects of human psychology. In the 1920s, psychologist John Watson went as far as denying completely the existence of the mind or consciousness, believing that individual behaviors, speech patterns, and emotional responses are simply a consequence of external stimuli which elicit certain responses via classical conditioning. Such an approach, taken to the extreme, negates subjective experience. In other words, 10 different people exposed to the same input would produce the same output. Interestingly, Pavlov never approved of the theories that behaviorists had built on the back of his experiments. The Russian scientist firmly believed in the importance of individuals in determining their behavior, and while he, as a physiologist, did not have the answers, he hoped science would one day explain it. He stated, "The mechanism and vital meaning of that which most occupied man are consciousness and its torments." In 1903, at the 14th International Medical Congress in Madrid, Pavlov read a paper on the experimental psychology and psychopathology of animals. His research was far from completed or exhaustive, yet his findings took the scientific community by storm. He only had to wait 1 year before he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine in 1904 in recognition of his work on the physiology of digestion, through which knowledge on vital aspects of the subject has been transformed and enlarged. From then on, the laurels piled upon Ivan's head. In 1907, he was elected academician of the Russian Academy of Sciences. In 1912, he was given an honorary doctorate from Cambridge University. In 1915, he was made a member of the French Order of the Legion of Honor. This was following a lobbying campaign by the Medical Academy of Paris. Now, this all takes us to just 2 years before a certain event which shook the world. When the October Revolution of 1917 ousted Kerensky's government and Lenin rose to power, Pavlov was 68 and had been a Nobel laureate for 13 years. He had no particular sympathies for the Tsarist regime, which had been notoriously stingy when it came to funding research. He wasn't terribly fond of communism either and would not hide his feelings about it. Ivan Pavlov was always vocal in his opposition to communism and its Russian incarnations. He only had two words to spare for Karl Marx: that fool. And he wasn't any kinder to the leaders of the Bolshevik Revolution. And yet, his international standing was unassailable, and Ivan could get away with the most outspoken and ferocious critiques of the regime. Pavlov considered communism a doomed experiment that had turned Russia back into a nation of serfs, and he saw Bolshevism as a system of government that devalued culture and the intellectual strength of a nation. So, how did Lenin treat this rogue but celebrated scientist? At first, Pavlov and his family were treated like any other Soviet citizens, which means that many of their assets were confiscated as property of the state, including the Nobel Prize money. Money that could have come in handy for the tough times that lay ahead. From 1917 to 1920, the revolutionary government had to defend itself against the White Armies in the Russian Civil War, a situation that caused generalized famine and fuel shortages for Russian citizens. Like most residents of Petrograd, the Pavlovs struggled to feed themselves and keep from freezing, as at least a third of Pavlov's colleagues at the Academy of Sciences starved or froze to death. Pavlov barely managed to keep his family alive by growing potatoes and other vegetables right outside his lab, and by collecting small amounts of firewood from a colleague. By 1920, Pavlov wrote to Lenin's secretary, seeking permission to emigrate to Western Europe or America in search of better living conditions and more funding for his lab. Lenin immediately realized the negative PR repercussions of losing the country's most celebrated scientist. He ordered Petrograd party leaders to increase rations for Pavlov and his family and to make sure that his working conditions improved. Ivan Pavlov had prevailed over Lenin thanks to his prestige. But would he have the same luck with his successor? Joseph Stalin started his climb to absolute power after Lenin's death in 1924, and by 1927 he had launched one of his many purges focused on intellectuals and scientists. Pavlov was outraged, especially when restrictive measures were aimed at Jewish scientists. Now, in his private life, Pavlov was as anti-Semitic as Stalin. In his view, Trotsky was a vile Yid. And in 1928, Pavlov had complained to an American college that Jews occupy high positions everywhere. It's a shame that the Russians cannot be rulers of their own land. But it is undisputed that the scientist had a strong sense of justice. At a time when vocal dissent may land you in a gulag or shot in the back of the head by a secret police goon, Pavlov wrote to Stalin complaining against the purge, saying that he was ashamed to be called a Russian. We don't know Stalin's reaction to such complaints, but we can speculate that he was not amused. Luckily for Pavlov, he could rely on powerful allies. Nikolai Bukharin, chairman of the Comintern's executive committee, considered Pavlov indispensable and defended his case with Politburo members. He stated, "I know that he does not sing the Internationale, but despite all his grumbling, ideologically, in his works, not in his speeches, he is working for us." In a case of pragmatism triumphing over paranoia, Stalin agreed with Bukharin and ensured the party would continue supporting Pavlov. The scientist and his labs continued to prosper even in the years leading up to Stalin's Great Purge. Pavlov expanded his operations to 3 laboratories staffed with hundreds of scientists and lab assistants, and was even permitted to collaborate with scholars in Europe and America. But his relationship with the government was never easy. Apparently, Moscow officials did not understand why their big boss allowed Pavlov to spit on the Soviets. This is how it was described by Politburo member Valerian Kubyshev. Kubyshev, who was chairman of the State Planning Committee and had influence over government investment in agriculture, industry, and science, tried to oppose Pavlov as much as he could, at least within the limits of what Stalin allowed him to do. This meant that Kubyshev was forced anyways to fund Pavlov's laboratories, but had no intention of ever honoring him. When a proposal was floated to celebrate Pavlov's 80th birthday as an affair of state, Kubyshev put his foot down. For a while, Kubyshev successfully prevented excessive displays of admiration towards the Nobel laureate, but by 1934, the hostile official had been removed from his post because, well, of course, that's how Stalin rolled. A good occasion to publicly celebrate the pride of Russian science arrived on the 27th of February 1936, although I'm sure Pavlov would have preferred to avoid it. Why? Well, this occasion was his death. Ivan Pavlov worked in his laboratory until the very end, even after contracting double pneumonia, which eventually claimed his life. The Soviet government honored the great scientist by organizing a grand funeral at which 100,000 mourners, including party officials, filed past his casket. Ivan Petrovich Pavlov was a physiologist until his very last day on Earth, and yet the impact of his work was felt most in psychology. His methods may not have been the most ethical, particularly when it came to our modern standards surrounding matters like animal cruelty. More broadly, the classical conditioning theories he spawned, as well as behaviorist psychology in general, were criticized by later generations of psychologists for being too reductive. Even Pavlov did not fully agree with strict classical conditioning theory, as it did not allow for the individual conscience to play a role in human behavior. Pavlov's true enduring legacy lies in the use of a rigorous scientific method to prove the existence of conditioned and non-conditioned reflexes, which provided a foundation for the study of acquired human behavior and the use of positive reinforcement in learning.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode. You listened all the way through, so hopefully you really liked it. If you did, why not go over to iTunes and leave us a review? It does make a huge difference. If you want it to be 5 stars, that is amazing, but give it whatever you felt we deserve. As always, I'll be back next time with another brand new episode, and thank you for listening.